We're living in this era where AI models are just becoming unimaginably massive. Like, we're talking billions or sometimes even trillions of parameters.
Yeah, absolutely massive.
Right. And these are mathematical structures that are so incomprehensibly large, they require entire warehouses just filled with specialized servers, massive cooling infrastructure, and immense power grids just to exist.
It's an incredible amount of hardware.
It really is.
Yeah.
But at the exact same time,
Huh?
somehow, we are still managing to run these incredibly powerful AI tools right on our laptops or, even locally on our smartphones. And when you stop and actually think about the physics of that, it's like, how is that mathematically possible? How do you fit a skyscraper into a shoebox?
Well, it is arguably one of the most compelling engineering paradoxes of our time. I mean, we are simultaneously scaling these models up to unprecedented sizes in the research labs while relentlessly trying to shrink them down for everyday deployment. Because the physics of memory and storage on your local devices, they haven't suddenly changed to accommodate this. Your phone still basically has the same RAM it had a few years ago, which means the software, the fundamental math holding the intelligence together, it had to evolve radically.
And that evolution is exactly what this deep dive is all about. Today, we're pulling from a massive, incredibly comprehensive research paper called Chat Compression Ideas for AI version 2.txt.
Right, it basically acts as a master catalog.
Yeah, it details exactly 100 distinct, highly technical methodologies for compressing AI model weights, activations, and underlying structures. But do not worry. Our mission today is not to overwhelm you by just reading a dry list of 100 different algorithms.
No, definitely not. That would take all day.
Right. Instead, we're extracting the core theoretical foundation, and then we're going to zoom in on three absolutely genius, wildly different philosophies of compression. By the end of this, you're going to understand exactly how modern AI is packaged up and shipped to your devices.
And what's great is seeing how these 100 ideas range from classical signal processing all the way to modern deep learning specific strategies. It really sets the stage for a journey through the whole evolution of compression.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because before we get to the really mind-bending futuristic stuff, we have to establish the universal tension that governs this entire field.
The eternal trade-off.
Yes, the trade-off between storage efficiency and reconstruction fidelity, or MSE. Basically, the golden rule of data compression is that you can't shrink something for free. Something is always lost.
Right. That is the immutable law of information theory. You're taking a high-resolution reality and forcing it into a lower resolution container.
It makes sense.
And the fidelity we talk about is simply how close the compressed model's output is to the original massive model's output. Because if you compress it too aggressively, the AI develops essentially a mathematical form of amnesia.
Oh, wow, amnesia.
Yeah, it becomes less accurate. More prone to hallucinations, and it forgets its nuances. So the entire game across all the methodologies we're looking at today is basically how do we throw away the maximum amount of data while minimizing the brain damage to the AI?
Which brings us to the foundational pipeline. Because before we can grasp the modern deep learning strategies, we have to understand the classic three-step blueprint that inspired this whole space.
Right, researchers were really forced to look back at classical signal processing to handle the exponential growth of neural networks.
Yeah, and we're talking about three sequential steps here:
Yeah.
discretization, indexing, and entropy coding.
Exactly. So think of a massive neural network's weights as incredibly precise numbers. We're talking about strings of decimals that just go on and on, representing a very specific tuning of a concept. Discretization comes in and says, we don't need infinite precision. We force those highly specific numbers to snap to a limited set of predetermined values on a rigid grid.
So you lose the micro nuance of the exact decimal, but you gain massive predictability.
Exactly. And then step two is indexing. We take those newly snapped values and replace them with integer references pointing to a lookup table, which is often called a code book.
Okay, so instead of storing the heavy actual number in memory, you just store a lightweight pointer that tells the system where to find the number in the code book.
You got it. And finally, you apply entropy coding to those pointers. This uses lossless algorithms, so think of classic compression tools like Zlib or Huffman coding.
Oh, sure, classics.
Yeah, a great way to conceptualize entropy coding is to think of Morse code. Like in Morse code, the letter E is just a single dot because it's the most common letter in the English language.
Right, and Q is much longer because it's rare.
Exactly. Entropy coding does the exact same thing to the AI's data. It looks at the statistical probability of your indices.
So if a certain index pointer appears very frequently, it gets assigned a very short binary code.
Right. You shrink the overall footprint based purely on statistical frequency. And what's fascinating here is how cutting-edge, state-of-the-art artificial intelligence still fundamentally relies on this old-school information theory.
It's wild.
It really is. The very foundation of making a multi-billion parameter language model fit on your phone is based on stripping away unnecessary precision to save space, which is a concept that predates modern AI by decades.
I love that.
Yeah.
Let me offer an analogy to make this super clear for you listening. Think of this whole three-step classical process like paint by numbers.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, imagine you have a gorgeous, incredibly complex painting with infinite subtle shades of custom mixed colors. That's our raw, uncompressed AI.
Right.
If you want to ship that painting to someone efficiently, you don't send a million tiny tubes of custom paint. Instead, you create a small palette of maybe 50 core colors, and that is your code book. Then you send them a blank canvas with a map of numbers telling them exactly where, say, blue number 4 goes. You lose the infinite shading, but the overall picture is preserved, and it's a fraction of the weight to ship.
That is a highly accurate visualization. But when we transition into modern AI, we aren't just sending a flat, two-dimensional painting.
Right, it gets more complicated.
Much more. The structural space of a neural network relies on massive, high-dimensional vectors. So a simple lookup table, like a basic paint-my-numbers palette, it completely breaks down when the canvas has thousands of dimensions.
Because the code book itself would just become astronomically large, right?
Exactly. It would defeat the entire purpose of compressing anything in the first place.
Which transitions us beautifully to the first of our three spotlight philosophies. How do we adapt that paint-by-numbers concept for a space that the human brain can barely even visualize?
Right. We need a method to handle massive vectors. And that brings us to a concept known as product quantization.
Product quantization. Okay.
Yeah. It's essentially taking a massive problem and dividing it to conquer it. The challenge is that a vector in an AI model, which is really just a mathematical representation of a concept, is huge. Huh. To understand this, imagine a 1024 dimensional vector.
Let's ground that really quickly. Think of that 1024 dimensional vector as a highly detailed recipe for a single concept, like the word ocean.
Right.
It holds everything the AI knows about that word. One dimension represents wetness, another represents depth, another is the color blue, another is temperature. And there are, you know, a thousand other subtle conceptual dimensions we don't even have English words for. That is one vector.
Exactly. And storing the entire holistic concept requires a lot of memory. A standard 524-dimensional float32 vector requires 32,768 bits of storage space.
That's just for one concept.
Yes. And if you have billions of those, you run out of server space very quickly. So product quantization uses a chop and swap approach. It takes that massive 1024-dimensional ocean vector and splits it into, say, 8 distinct subvectors.
Okay, so you chop the 1024 dimensions into 8 smaller chunks of 128 dimensions each.
Right, you break the big recipe into smaller, manageable pieces. And then each of those 8 smaller subspaces gets its own tiny, dedicated code book.
I see.
Yeah. And these code books are trained using a clustering algorithm called K-means.
Okay. And all you need to know about K-means is that it basically scans through millions of data points and finds the archetype or the average mold for a specific group of shapes.
Exactly. It finds the most representative patterns for each small chunk of data.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because, wait, hold on. If we are arbitrarily chopping this vector's mathematical thoughts into 8 disconnected pieces, doesn't the AI lose the big picture of what that data actually means?
That's a really good question.
Like, if you sever the connection between the wetness dimension and the depth dimension of the ocean by putting them in different subchunks, doesn't the concept degrade?
Yeah, that is the exact vulnerability of this method, actually. And it results in what we call boundary artifacts.
Boundary artifact.
Right, because a vector in an AI model represents a holistic, interconnected concept, just as you described. When you arbitrarily chop it into subvectors, the values that sit right on the split point, the boundary, they lose their contextual awareness of the values on the other side of the split.
Ah, so the algorithm compressing chunk number 2 has no idea what is happening in chunk number 3.
Exactly. So when the AI tries to reconstruct the full vector to answer a prompt, it's a bit like assembling Frankenstein's monster.
If I see.
The individual pieces are mostly correct, but the seams where they join can be slightly jarring. It introduces a specific kind of mathematical error.
But the space savings must be worth those jagged seams, right? Let's talk about the math on this chop and swap method, because this is where my jaw genuinely dropped when looking through the research.
Oh, yeah. The combinatorial efficiency is staggering. Going back to our example, that single 1,024-dimensional vector originally required 32,768 bits.
Yeah.
By splitting it into 8 pieces and using codebooks with, say, 256 centroids, which only require an 8-bit index pointer to locate the right archetype shape.
You only need to store 8 tiny pointers.
Exactly. 8 pieces at 8 bits each is 64 bits total.
Wait, really?
Yeah. You just went from 32,768 bits down to 64 bits. That is a 512 times compression factor for a single mathematical concept.
That is unbelievable. It's incredible that the AI still functions at all after shrinking the data by a factor of 512.
Right.
But this product quantization approach is still focused on directly compressing the numbers themselves. Right, it's chopping up the data.
Correct.
What if we approach the problem from a completely different angle? Like, what if the mathematical structure holding those numbers is actually mostly empty space?
And that pivot takes us to our second spotlight philosophy. We move away from manipulating individual indices and start manipulating the structural linear algebra. We are talking about the skeleton approach, which relies heavily on principles like truncated singular value decomposition or truncated SVD and a very popular method known as LoRA.
Let's dive into this skeleton idea, because deep neural networks are known to be over-parameterized. Basically, they have way more parameters than they strictly need to function.
Yeah, exactly.
Their massive weight matrices are what mathematicians call low rank.
Right. And the concept of low rank is really crucial to understand here. Imagine a massive spreadsheet filled with thousands of rows and columns of temperature data.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
But let's say the first column is the temperature in Celsius, the second column is the exact same temperature converted to Fahrenheit, the third is Kelvin, and so on.
I see where you're going.
Even though the spreadsheet is physically enormous and filled with different numbers, the true underlying information, the actual unique data variance, is tiny. You really only need one column to derive all the rest.
Right, so the matrix has a massive physical size, but a very low rank of actual information.
Exactly. And neural networks naturally learn these low rank structures. They build out these giant redundant spreadsheets during their training phase.
So instead of storing the whole redundant spreadsheet, we use singular value decomposition, which is basically a mathematical process that takes one giant complex block of numbers and factors it into a combination of much smaller fundamental blocks.
Right. You extract the core structural pillars of the matrix. And the key to compression here is the truncated part of truncated SVD.
Meaning we chop something off?
Exactly. You line up these structural pillars in order of importance, and then you just throw the least important ones away. You truncate the math.
Wow.
And by doing this, you're left with two much smaller matrices, which are commonly referred to in the engineering space as matrix A and matrix B.
And this is not just abstract theory for the lab either. If you, the listener, have ever fine-tuned an open-source large language model on your own hardware, you've almost certainly used this.
Oh, absolutely.
It is the exact mechanism behind LoRA, which stands for low-rank adaptation. Instead of trying to update and store a massive multi-gigabyte file of new fine-tuned weights, the system just stores these two tiny A and B matrices, the lightweight adapters.
It is absolute mathematical elegance in practice. But again, we return to the universal tension. You cannot shrink something for free.
Right. Something is always lost.
Exactly. By truncating the matrix and throwing away the bottom pillars, you are discarding the tail of singular values. And those bottom values aren't just empty noise.
What are they?
They often contain high-frequency features, intricate nuances, or rare, highly specific niche knowledge that the AI learned during its initial training.
Okay, let's visualize this. It's like looking at the two-dimensional shadow of a complex three-dimensional object. If a horse casts a shadow on a wall, you easily get the overall structural shape, the skeleton, if you will. You immediately know it's a horse.
Right, the shape is obvious.
But by reducing three dimensions to two, you completely lose the microscopic surface texture, the exact color of the coat, the depth of the muscles. That lost texture is that tale of rare knowledge the AI sacrifices to get smaller.
The shadow analogy works perfectly. The AI maintains its core structural competency. It still knows how to speak English, format code, and follow instructions.
Sure.
But it might suffer noticeable performance drops on extreme outlier tasks or highly specialized trivia because the detailed texture required for those edge cases was basically truncated away to save space.
Okay, so we've covered chopping up high-dimensional vectors with codebooks, and we've covered factoring redundant spreadsheets down to their skeletal shadows.
Right.
Both of those methods still involve storing parts of the original AI's brain. But this brings us to a third philosophy that honestly sounds like straight-up science fiction.
Yeah, you were referring to neural implicit weight representations, and this is where the field completely abandons the concept of explicit storage altogether.
I like to call it the inception technique, an AI within an AI. It's just a massive paradigm shift.
It really is.
With this method, you throw away the original massive grid of numbers entirely. You do not store the AI's weight matrices on your hard drive at all.
None of it.
Instead, you train a separate, incredibly tiny neural network, like a miniature AI, to memorize the patterns of the massive AI. Whenever the system needs a specific weight value, the tiny AI literally hallucinates the correct number on demand based on a grid coordinate.
Right. It forces us to completely rethink what it means to store data. Rather than storing the raw numbers, you are storing a tiny mathematical function that knows how to generate the numbers on the fly.
That is wild.
Yeah, you train this miniature neural network, which is often a very simple multi-layer perceptron, by feeding it a coordinate, like row 5, column 10. The tiny network learns the overarching mathematical surface of the data.
Ah, so it's similar to how you don't need to memorize every point on the edge of the circle if you just know the algebraic equation for a circle?
Exactly. And let's look at the sheer scale of the space savings here. If you have a standard 1,000 by 1,000 matrix in your AI model, that is 1 million distinct parameters.
Right.
Stored normally, that takes up roughly 4 megabytes of hard drive space. But if you switch to this implicit method, you can train a tiny generator network with just 2 hidden layers of 64 neurons to map that entire space.
Wow.
And that tiny network requires only about 4,300 parameters to operate. So you store those 4,300 parameters instead of the original 1 million?
That's a massive difference.
Yeah, it's greater than a 200 times compression factor. Achieved not by zipping files, but by replacing millions of static data points with a dynamic algebraic formula that mimics them perfectly.
Right.
This raises an important question. What happens to the system's performance when the main AI actually needs to think and generate a response? We have moved away from the trade-off of losing rare knowledge. We are now confronting a severe new bottleneck, which is inference overhead.
So what does this all mean for the end user? I mean, aren't we just trading a storage problem for a computation problem?
Pretty much.
Like, if I am trying to run this on my phone, and the phone's processor has to do complex math through a secondary AI just to remember what the primary AI knows before it can even begin to answer my prompt, isn't that going to absolutely drain my battery or slow the generation speed down to a crawl?
You've identified the exact flaw in the implicit paradigm. Computing a weight on the fly using a tiny neural network is inherently physically slower than simply reading a static number from RAM.
It has to be.
Yeah. Every single time the main model needs a piece of its own brain to process your prompt, it has to ask the tiny model to calculate it first. And the latency compounds rapidly.
Right.
Furthermore, this method struggles immensely with chaotic data. The tiny network is great at learning smooth, predictable patterns. Mm. But if a weight matrix is highly noisy or randomly initialized, the miniature AI basically cannot find a cohesive geometric pattern to memorize, and the entire compression attempt fails.
It's a conceptually brilliant idea, but maybe not the silver bullet for every single deployment scenario.
Mm.
Which actually leads us perfectly to the ultimate synthesis of this deep dive.
Exactly.
We've explored 3 completely distinct philosophies today. Product quantization, chopping up vectors, LoRa isolating structural skeletons, and neural implicit representations using an AI to generate an AI.
Right.
Who wins? Like, which one is the correct way to compress a model?
Well, the reality of modern engineering is that none of them win on their own. The true future of AI compression and what the most advanced labs are doing right now relies entirely on hybrid pipelines.
Ah, you combine them.
Exactly. The most effective strategies never rely on just one isolated technique. You combine them to multiply the effects.
So you stack them up like a multi-stage rocket to reach orbit.
That's a great way to put it. If we connect this to the bigger picture, researchers are systematically layering these philosophies.
Okay, how does that look in practice?
For instance, they'll take a massive open source model. First, they apply pruning to sever completely unnecessary neural connections.
Right, get rid of the dead weight.
Then they apply quantization to lower the precision of the weights that remain. Finally, they apply entropy coding to compress the resulting pointers based on statistical frequency.
Wow.
These are multiplicative reductions, easily shrinking models by more than a factor of 10 without destroying the core intelligence.
And we even see this synthesis happening with the specific techniques we just walked through, right?
Yeah.
Look at LoRa. You extract those two tiny A and B skeleton adapters, but you don't stop there. You can further compress those skeletal matrices using 4-bit quantization, creating a method known as QLoRa.
Exactly.
You take the low-rank structural compression and you smash it together with the classical discretization pipeline we talked about at the very beginning of the show. It results in extreme compound compression.
It is the ultimate synthesis of distinct disciplines. You have classical 1950s information theory, linear algebra, and modern deep learning all working in concert to defy the physical limitations of consumer hardware.
And for you listening, this hybrid approach is the exact reason why you do not need access to a $1 million server farm to run incredible, highly capable AI tools today.
Exactly.
It is why a robust language model can run natively on your laptop, completely offline, reading your documents or writing code. It's not magic. It is dozens of distinct stacking layers of brilliant mathematical shortcuts.
It fundamentally democratizes access to the technology. The cognitive reasoning of the model remains remarkably robust, but the physical requirement to host that reasoning shrinks exponentially, putting the power directly into the hands of the public.
So, to briefly wrap up our journey today, we started with the basic paint-by-numbers indices, discretizing infinite precise decimals into finite grids.
Right.
Then we moved to slicing massive redundant spreadsheets into low-rank skeletal shadows.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, we explored the inception-like reality of training tiny neural networks to mathematically hallucinate the brains of bigger neural networks.
A truly phenomenal evolution of software engineering.
It really is. But before we go, I want to leave you with a completely new angle to think about, something we haven't touched on yet, drawn from the very end of the research. Technique 99. It involves the concept of secure obfuscation.
Yes. The hidden secondary utility of compression.
Yeah. Because throughout this entire deep dive, we've assumed that compression is purely an engineering pursuit aimed at saving hard drive space, you know, conserving battery life or speeding up processing times.
Right.
But the research reveals that compression has a massive hidden second use, intellectual property protection.
It makes complete sense when you consider the economics of the industry. As these extremely powerful multi-million-dollar models get smaller and smaller, they become infinitely easier to copy onto a thumb drive or download over a basic internet connection.
And essentially to steal. And the research details how developers can deliberately encrypt weight indices before the entropy coding stage.
Right.
By doing this, you are intrinsically obfuscating the AI's brain at the most foundational mathematical level.
It's Loctite.
So I want you to ponder this as you go about your day. We always talk about compression making AI smaller so it can fit in our pockets. But could the real future of AI compression actually be less about saving hard drive space and more about corporate entities locking their proprietary intelligence inside complex, unbreakable mathematical origami?
That is a fascinating thought.
We started this deep dive wondering how you mathematically fit a skyscraper into a shoebox. The lingering question for the future might just be, once it is inside the shoebox, how do you make absolutely sure no one else can open it?